It's Friday, April 16th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, Future Proof, we talk about artificial intelligence, automation, and coping with technological change with New York Times reporter Kevin Roos. His new book lays out 9 rules for how all of us can handle the technological future. Then, Tough Questions, we throw our difficult questions about free speech to Pen America CEO Suzanne Nossel. She talks about AI's impacts on free speech, clashes between police and demonstrators in Minnesota, and the release of a Turkish journalist. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Pen Pod. New York Times technology reporter Kevin Roos has been covering Silicon Valley for the paper since 2017. His new book, Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation, is out now and offers a roadmap for those perhaps skittish about how algorithms are taking over our lives. Kevin Roos joins me now. Hi, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, not a problem. So let's start with the book, Future Proof. Why did you write the book, and why 9 rules?
Well, I have been looking at AI and automation for a long time. I mean, out here in the Bay Area, it's, you know, all anyone talks about except maybe Bitcoin and NFTs now. But I was sort of curious, like, what the sort of real story was there, because you hear people talk about AI and automation, and they're either purely optimistic, like this is going to solve all our problems and usher in a glorious age of, you know, leisure, and we'll all be artists, and, you know, the robots will do all our dirty work. Or you have this sort of extreme pessimistic version that says that robots are going to take all the jobs, we'll be useless, you know, at best we'll be, you know, slaves to the robots on Elon Musk's, you know, Mars colony or whatever.
Right.
And that kind of drove me crazy, because it was very theoretical, and it was pretty impractical. Like, both sides were sort of saying, like, this is going to happen and there's nothing you can do about it. But I thought there was something to do about it. Like, and I wanted to know what that was. You know, should we all learn to code? Should we, you know, put all our work on the blockchain? Like, do we start, you know, sucking up to Alexa so that she won't, you know, kill us during the uprising? So the book is sort of divided into 2 parts. The first half is kind of what's happening with AI and automation, and sort of that's kind of the diagnosis part. And the second half is really the prescriptive part. That's the sort of, how do we survive this? How do we keep our jobs and maintain our sanity and help our communities through this technological shift?
Yeah, I want to parse through a couple of those things, but just first, you know, we're Pen America. We are concerned about free expression. And, you know, one of the things that we've been really concerned about is how AI, how automation, especially like on social platforms, could quickly lead to censorship. You know, take down social posts, filter out words that basically makes our digital speech less free. And I'm wondering, like, from that point of view, how do you see us being able to embrace AI, especially when it comes to content and editorial, in a way that lets us not give up free speech?
Yeah, it's a really interesting balance. I mean, I think that one of the jobs that we have learned that robots are actually not very good at is content moderation.
Right.
You know, we have automated a lot of jobs in content moderation, and there used to be a job called editor and producer, and there still are some of those hanging around. I have great ones, but a lot of those jobs have been automated, because now most of our information gets to us filtered through these sort of algorithmic screens. And, you know, AI makes some good decisions, it makes some bad decisions. But that's actually a job that humans are still better at. So that's a thing that I think we're the tech companies are sort of learning, is they're kind of de-automating that job by bringing in humans to sort of make decisions that are too hard for the machines to make accurately. So I think we can embrace AI as sort of part of the answer to sort of misinformation and hate speech, but you're right that it does raise new questions about censorship, at least when humans censor things, you know, and you can, you know, yell at them and blame them and mount opposition campaigns. You know, when bots censor things, you might not even know it existed. And there's a lot less sort of recourse in that case. And I think we also need to think about it on the production side too. It's not just that AI is going to be sort of censoring people. It's that a lot of the content we consume is going to be produced by AI fairly soon. It's not just going to be, you know, like it'll be music, it'll be movies, it'll be the written word. So much of what is going to happen in content moderation, I think, is sort of robots censoring other robots. And that's something to really think through too.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I think that you do really well in the book is, you know, oftentimes we get locked into these conversations, especially around AI, automation, and the economy, that it's all sort of like the robots are coming for our jobs. Automation, AI are coming for our jobs. You paint this picture a little bit at Davos, which is a little bit terrifying. By day, everyone's magnanimous. By night, trying to find ways to fire all of their employees. But you, I think, are making a greater point about, shouldn't these things make our lives better? Like qualitatively make our lives better. And I wonder where you sort of, after, you know, doing all the reporting for this book, where you come down on that question.
Well, I think technology and in general and AI and automation in specific can make our lives better and should make our lives better. I mean, that is the promise of technology, is that it does things that we don't want to do or that we shouldn't have to do or that are dangerous for us to do. And we get to spend more time doing the things that actually give us joy and meaning and connection. And that future is still possible. But right now we're making a lot of choices sort of collectively and you know, in positions of leadership that are not getting us closer to that, that are not freeing workers from mundane and boring work, that are actually creating more mundane and boring work. We're not getting, you know, tools that are sort of giving us back more time to do the things we value. Instead, they're taking time from us. They're stealing our attention. They're commandeering our you know, free time with, you know, algorithmic feeds and recommendations. And so I think we need to get back to this mission of using technology to actually empower ourselves and not to kind of place new forms of restriction on ourselves.
And I guess it's a little bit divorced from automation and AI per se, but I'm wondering how that perspective and how your perspective on all of this was altered by COVID-19 and the pandemic. I mean, in some ways, like it shed new light on medical technology and health technology, on work from home technology. I mean, did that change your outlook at all, or did it kind of double down on the things that you thought were already happening in these waves of AI and automation?
Well, I think it accelerated things. I mean, when I was writing the first draft of this book before the pandemic, I was thinking, you know, we might start to see some of this AI and automation happening in the next, you know, 5 years. Maybe it would take 10 years. Maybe I would get credit for sort of being ahead of the curve. But instead, what happened was that the pandemic happened and I had to rewrite parts of my book because the things that I thought were going to happen 5 years from now were actually happening in real time. Automation has really, really accelerated in the past year as a result of the pandemic. And so I think it hasn't changed my outlook so much as made it more urgent and made me think that, you know, this is something that we all need to be thinking about much sooner.
And I don't want to, you know, parse everything down to the economy, but obviously that's where a lot of these anxieties lie. And it's where you do spend some time in the book. I mean, you write about, like, you know, 10 years ago, we wouldn't have thought that drone cinematographer was a job, and now it is. And that, you know, there is this potential for job growth to come from this, but you sort of take apart a little bit this presumption that, oh, we'll just replace all the jobs. There's going to be all these new jobs that crop up because of automation, and that it sort of subtracts the agency from any of this. I wonder if you can say a little more.
Yeah, so this is the line that I bought for a long time and that you hear all the time in the tech world is, you know, oh, well, you know, look what happened in the Industrial Revolution. You know, all the farmers got jobs in the factories and, you know, average quality of life went up and we no longer had to, you know, bale hay by hand or whatever. And so why would you worry about this wave of technology? And so I dug into that. I went back and actually read a bunch of, like, contemporaneous accounts of the Industrial Revolution. And what stuck out is, like, how hard that was for people. Like, people did not experience that as, like, an immediate and, you know, and lasting improvement in their quality of life. There were brutal working conditions. There was lots of child labor. I mean, this was not, you know, an ideal work environment for people. And so I think it's true that in the aggregate and over the long run, technology does tend to make our lives better. We probably wouldn't switch lives with our great-grandparents, many of us. But I think that we need to listen to the people who are telling us right now how technology is making their lives worse and how, you know, jobs in Amazon warehouses, you know, are turning people into essentially human robots because they're just following instructions from a machine all day. I think we need to take those things seriously because it is not the case that everyone who goes through these technological shifts experiences that as a positive thing.
Right, right. I mean, and I think it also comes to this point of you write that, you know, none of this is predetermined, that there is choice in the matter, that there's agency in the matter. I think that's hard for people who like look at Jeff Bezos or look at Mark Zuckerberg and they look at these big companies and they say, I don't have a role here. I don't have a stake in this. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would just say, look at what's happening at those companies. I mean, you just mentioned Facebook and Amazon. I mean, Amazon is having a union fight right now. I mean, the workers are saying, we don't want to work like this. We want to see more humane conditions, but we also want to see better pay because we feel like you're making billions of dollars and you know, we're not seeing it. At Facebook, they're not unionizing, but there's certainly employees that are certainly speaking up and saying we need to do more about hate speech. We need to do more about misinformation. A lot of the actual activism at Facebook is coming from people at the company and you know, with ties to the company. So I think we sort of accept that technology is something that just happens to us and we either sort of get on board or get off the train, but we have control. We are in charge ultimately of how these technologies are deployed and used and regulated. And we have done that throughout history. We have sort of adapted technology to our needs and our priorities and made it work for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm curious if I may, So now the book is out, but you know, I'm just as a writerly question, probably not what you envisioned for a book tour, for the book coming out. How has this experience been, you know, having, I mean, I know this isn't your first book, but having this book come out amid a pandemic, what's that experience been like and what's the reception been like so far?
It's been really interesting. I mean, I think, you know, for my first two books, I did a much more kind of traditional book tour. You know, you hit the road, you do six or eight cities, you sign some books at some bookstores, you know, you maybe go on TV. So this has just totally been, I mean, it's a much different media environment now, obviously, than it was 10 years ago or whenever my first book came out. But it's really been interesting. I mean, I've been able to do so much, to talk to so many people. I've done clubhouses and podcasts and Twitter spaces and, you know, and just tons and tons of formats. And I'm just really, I'm excited that people are reading it. It's the most practical book I've ever written. Most of my two other books were, you know, reported nonfiction, but they didn't have this kind of like advice component. And so it's a departure mm-hmm. for me. And I was nervous about how that would land with people or whether people would think I was trying to, you know, pivot into being a lifestyle coach and like a Tony Robbins, you know, style right. marketing guru. But no, it's been really gratifying to see people, you know, reading it and talking about how they're implementing the advice. And it's a new kind of utility that I'm not used to having as a writer.
Yeah. Well, the book is Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. It's written by Tony Robbins' protege, Kevin Roos, who's also a New York Times reporter. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. And sign up for my next Tony Robbins style motivational seminar. It's very affordable. We're having it at Madison Square Garden.
Can't wait.
All right. Thanks, Stephen.
It's that time again. Friday means time for Tough Questions. That's where we put tricky questions about free speech to our CEO, Suzanne Nossel. She joins me now. Hey, Suzanne.
Hey, Stephen.
So, Suzanne, we just heard from the New York Times' Kevin Roos about content moderation and artificial intelligence. I want to know what you think the risks are of these technologies, especially when it comes to free speech.
Yeah, I mean, I think at bottom, it comes down to the very real and profound limitations of AI when it comes to discerning something as nuanced as the bounds of free speech and open discourse. I am not an expert, but what I do know is that AI systems sort of do best when they're making binary decisions, you know, when there's certain criteria that are met or not met, and, you know, a machine can essentially judge thumbs up or thumbs down. In the realm of speech, that's very rarely the case. I mean, you might have a slur word that is a clear red line. You know, if this word appears, it gets deleted. And maybe that's appropriate, although, you know, could there be some circumstances where it's being used satirically or where someone's quoting critically quoting a political leader or public figure who has used the slur, and there might be grounds to leave it up. And so the notion of entrusting such a decision to a machine is troubling in that there are so many nuances. I mean, when in my book, I devote a chapter to the importance of intent and context in judging and reacting to speech. And, you know, that's where AI systems really fall down. You know, they can't sort of know the larger context. It's too sprawling. It's too indefinite. It's too nuanced. They can't discern intent. You know, they don't have the sort of human cues that we rely on to understand, you know, what lies beneath words, what the import of words are, how the meaning of words may differ depending on who's doing the speaking and in what setting and with what tone and, you know, what sort of indicators of seriousness or levity or emotion or other elements may come into it. And so, look, the temptation to turn to AI is overwhelming because the volume of decisions is overwhelming. And, you know, my hope is perhaps there's sort of some equilibrium that we can reach where machines are doing some of the issue spotting, if you will, and flagging posts for human review that may skate close to a borderline. But I think that is a much more comfortable prospect than entrusting to bots and mechanized systems sort of the authority of being an arbiter of speech, of determining what stays on a platform and what disappears, with only kind of a resort to ex post facto appeal, which, you know, can really mean that in the moment the speech is suppressed, perhaps baselessly. And so I think the tools need to be rolled out very delicately. I mean, I'm interested in, you know, what we can learn over time. You know, can we hone these systems so that, you know, when a flag, for example, is overruled, the fact of that somehow gets processed, and so that the future flagging is more refined. So, you know, I think there's potential here, but also a lot of peril.
Absolutely. Well, I want to turn now to Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. A police officer this week was formally charged in the killing of Dante Wright. Demonstrations there continue. Dozens have been arrested, confrontations with police. You know, it seems so far, at least, we haven't seen violations of First Amendment rights, perhaps as egregious as some of the ones we saw last summer. But it does seem like our police departments in this country can't cope with these major demonstrations without resorting to force. Why is that?
Yeah, look, I think there is a sort of systematic lack of both training and kind of organization and configuration to deal with mass protest events. You know, it really calls upon a different force structure, operational plan, and skill set than does sort of normal everyday policing, you know, in neighborhoods, doing traffic stops, going after crime. You know, it's quite different. You're dealing with masses of people. You're dealing with situations in which emotions run high. You know, you're on public property, sometimes private property, with, you know, issues of protecting infrastructure or, you know, storefronts, et cetera, homes from being violated in some way. And so, you know, what seems clear, and, you know, the other fact is it doesn't happen all the time, you know, and we have gone through periods in this country where, you know, kind of boisterous protest is quite infrequent, and then, you know, periods where it really surges up. And so, you know, I think ultimately we need our police departments to coordinate in such a way that they are ready when these surges happen. And maybe it's a matter of collectivizing, you know, across departments. I mean, the question of whether each and every single department. You know, for example, a place like Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis, or Minnesota, which, you know, not a well-known town, not a big town, you know, could anybody have quite foreseen that that was going to be the locus? You know, would that a police department sort of have known, you know, this is something they need to be training for and on notice for? You know, maybe not, but could there be, you know, at the level of a municipality or a county, a capability to help step in and organize and orient and, you know, quickly implement, you know, a surge capacity of trained, briefed police under a command structure that can deal with this stuff appropriately? Because it's quite clear that asking ordinary cops to sort of turn around and be an appropriate police force for mass protests is really failing us, and in fact exacerbating, you know, the very conflicts and tensions between communities and police that are giving rise to these protests. So it's clear something has to be done.
Yeah. Well, let me just quickly go to a bright spot this week in Turkey, where a court released journalist Ahmet Altan, who had spent 4 years behind bars on bogus charges related to the country's 2016 failed coup attempt. How is it that 5 years after that coup attempt, the country is still attempting to punish its critics like this?
Well, because, you know, it's because the tensions linger. And sort of the fundamental threat that the Erdogan government sees from dissenters, you know, it remains powerful. And there's a sense of vulnerability and insecurity that has led to a persistent atmosphere of crackdown. And so, you know, in the case of Ahmet Altan, you know, there was appeal to the European Court of Human Rights that rendered a decision demanding his freedom and accusing Turkey of violating his civil rights. And, you know, that was very important. And it's sort of a good example of where international human rights institutions and sort of the moral voice that they carry can make a real difference, a visible difference. You know, we're getting ready to release our annual count of writers in prison in 2020. And, you know, we do a lot of thinking about, you know, what really are the remedies here? How do you mobilize, you know, beyond our own sense of outrage and campaigning on behalf of these dissidents? What are the other mechanisms? So this is sort of a heartening example where sort of the rule of human rights law actually prevailed for somebody who, you know, was sentenced to life imprisonment for, you know, these spurious charges of overthrowing the government. He had been, you know, gone up on appeal, and the sentence was reduced to 10 years for supporting a terrorist organization. So there was, you know, sort of clearly some sense, you know, of restraint and not wanting to let the powers that be go as far as they wanted to essentially lock him up and throw away the key. But to see him, you know, now able to walk free is very positive. And, you know, perhaps it serves Erdogan, you know, at this moment as they Turkey tries to rebuild a relationship with the U.S. with the new administration. You know, that may have played a part in it as well. But I think kind of directly defying the European Court of Human Rights was, you know, seemingly not something even Turkey was willing to do.
Yeah. Well, again, some good news this week. Suzanne Nossel is CEO of PEN America. She's also author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thanks so much.
And that's our episode for Friday, April 16th. Join us next week for the PEN Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at PEN.org. Follow us at PEN America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for PEN America. This is the PEN Pod. See you soon.